Hello and welcome to The Paranormal Sun, coming to you live from Tower Studios. I'm JT, and each week I'll be your tour guide as we explore the unexplained. A small dairy town in Texas encountered something extraordinary over three nights in January of 2008. Several citizens spotted white lights above the highway. The lights were first seen in a single horizontal arc and then in vertical parallel lines. No sound was heard. A few days later, the U.S. Air Force revealed that some aircraft were flying near the town that day. So, case closed, right? Dig a bit further below the surface and you will see that the explanation may not be so simple. And you will soon understand why the blanket explanation did not sit well with the Stephenville residents, as what many saw was much further technologically advanced. And if these were simply some aircraft, then why were two F-16s spotted pursuing them with their afterburners fully engaged? And why were these aircraft headed towards some of the most restricted airspace west of the Mississippi River? People wonder what in the world it is, because this is the Bible Belt, and everyone is afraid. It's the end of times, said Stephen Allen, a freight company owner and pilot, who said the object he saw was a mile long and half a mile wide. It was positively, absolutely nothing from these parts. Join me tonight as we delve into the amazing three-day phenomenon known as the Stephenville Lights, one of the most intriguing UFO events of the 21st century to this point. Well, good evening, everyone. I hope you're well wherever you are in the world. I hope that this year's treating you all right. I know it's been a hell of a year for many of us, but I hope that it's started to calm down wherever you are. And as always, like I say, thank you for listening to this program. I really appreciate everyone who takes the time to listen. I've got listeners all over the globe, and it really helps me keep going when I have people listening and commenting and giving me feedback. It really means a lot. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. We've had a few things going on in Tower Studios. The weather's been a bit windy and rough, so it's been good that I've been able to get the recording in when I can. Yeah, it's a bit unsettled. I mean, it's still spring here technically. So yeah, it's a bit windy, bit rainy, but we definitely need the rain, so we'll take it. Now, I just want to give a couple of quick shout outs here. Now, you know, normally I always give everyone a shout out, all of my long-term listeners and friends, and you all know from the bottom of my heart how much it means, but going forward, folks, I'm going to try and start truncating that a little bit, just because people probably get tired of hearing me bleed on about the same things. So I do just want to give you a few show updates of what's been going on. So I'm pleased to announce I've been working to try and get a YouTube channel set up. I've also launched the Paranormal Sun on Twitter and also on Stellar. Now, many people won't know what OnStellar is, but it's basically a similar platform to Facebook, not quite the same, but it's got much more of a, let's say, paranormal slash UFO slash new age vibe to it. It's a bit rougher than Facebook. It's similar to the old MySpace setup, but if you get a chance and you want to check out something new, head over there. There are a lot of people over there that post quite a bit of good content. And again, as I say, I've started using Twitter for the Paranormal Sun. So if you want to go over and follow, just like this show, look for the Paranormal Sun. On all of the social media and different platforms, I try to use the same artwork as the podcast, so it should be easy for you to spot. Now, with the YouTube channel, I'm a bit torn what I want to do. I know that it will help draw listeners, but I don't want to just go and release everything over there on YouTube, or what's the point of hosting a podcast? So right now, I'm just going to be uploading a few episodes. I'm undecided what I'm going to do over there. You know, will I just release certain episodes and try and get people to come and listen to the podcast, or will I post chunks of episodes? But right now, you know, for now, I've got the beta version of the Paranormal Sun, which was actually an episode of The Fortunate Sun, for those of you who may not have listened, which was Myths and Legends of the Pacific Northwest. It was basically the first show that really kind of delved into this subject matter. So if you haven't had a chance, go over there and check that out. I think you would really like it. You know, it would really help the program. You know, people often do ask me, oh, well, you know, what can we do, JT, to help support you? Like I say, you know, you can go and like and follow the Paranormal Sun on Instagram. You can go and like the Facebook page. You can go on Twitter. You can, you know, add me on Twitter. You can also go to the YouTube channel and subscribe to the YouTube channel. Now, that would be a really big help, because once you get 1,000 subscribers, it starts to unlock a lot of different features. So that would be a big help if you've got time to just go over and like and subscribe stuff over there on the YouTube channel. Like I say, also, if you'd like to support the show further, you can go to theparanormalsun.com and you can drop a few dollars in the PayPal link there if you're feeling generous. If you want to be even more supportive, you can go over to Patreon and support the Paranormal Sun. Any and all of that is appreciated, and I really do appreciate those who have supported me in the past, especially to Harry and Lisa in North Carolina. Without their generous support, folks, I don't know if the Paranormal Sun would still be rolling, because I don't have much of a budget, and they have helped me allow a lot of this content to get to your ears. So, you know, pat on the back to Harry and Lisa. Thank you so much for your support. Now, something else that happened this last week, which was quite awesome. Russell from Hangar 18 Radio had me on his program for a bit of an interview. I don't really look at it as an interview, because it was much more a conversation between two friends. And it was basically what I've been referring to as a paranormal fireside chat. And it was awesome. You know, we really enjoyed it. We kind of let the conversation lead us where we may, mainly about UFOs, but we did speak about ghosts and spirits and some of the paranormal. So if you haven't had a chance, go over there and check that episode out. If you need a link or anything, you know, you can find it through my social media. And again, that's Hangar 18 Radio, all one word, you know, Hangar 18 Radio. And again, like I say, there have been a few podcasts that have gone above and beyond to support the program. One of them is The Old 77, Scott, Matt, and Dave. Again, thanks for all of your help. Thank you so much to Noel over at the Quite Unusual Podcast. Look, Noel and Nicole have been brilliant and really helpful and really supportive, but I'm looking at trying to bring you something new soon. Now, to get that done, I needed some assistance from someone in the U.S., and Noel took the time to go on and help me out. So, Noel, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for the help. And anyone who hasn't, if you want to go and listen to some of the similar topics that I cover, you know, they've covered the Skinwalker Ranch over there, they've covered Roswell, but they also do a lot of true crime stories and, you know, a lot of unsolved cases in that. So, you know, go over there and check out the Quite Unusual Podcast. It's a brilliant listen, and they have a lot of fun over there broadcasting from the Haunted Attic. So with all of that said, folks, like I say, if you're listening to the show, give yourself a pat on the back. Again, I really appreciate everything that you've done, and I appreciate your support all over the world, all over the U.S., Australia, New Zealand, Europe, South America, Africa, Asia. I've got listeners all over, and thank you so much for taking the time to listen. Now, through the rest of the year, I will be releasing an episode every week for you. So right now, the plan is to even release them over the holidays. When we get to another 20 episodes, that will be the end of season 2. And then I'll probably take a 1 or 2 week hiatus just to have a bit of a break, recharge the batteries. Again, at this point, folks, I'm still not employed, and it doesn't look like I'm going to be employed in the near future. So right now, you continue to get to really enjoy this content. When I go back to work, because unfortunately, you know, the life of a podcaster does not make you rich and famous. Most of the people who do it really already had connections or were already famous before they started their podcast. So, you know, short of some miracle of funding, some rich Patreon who decides that they're going to fund the show, I will be going back to work at some point. But again, I will keep you posted, and I will do my absolute best to let you know what's going on with the program. Now, on that point, you know, the two programs are completely separate, but The Fortunate Son, I've been asked a few times by people, what's the go with The Fortunate Son? Are you going to release new content? Yes, I probably will. The Fortunate Son, look, I am what you would refer to as an empath. I'm not so up with the new age terms, but, you know, in the last few years, several people have told me I'm an empath. I get quite attached to my emotions and it drains me. So doing things like that, where it's quite emotional content, it does take a toll. I will be doing some episodes at some point. A great supporter of the show in Texas has asked me to dust off the mic and do another episode. She feels that in this time, with the world in the shape that it's in right now and all the negativity and everything else, that my content has been worthwhile and that she would love to have another episode. So I will be doing at least one more before the end of the year. I would like to do a few, but we will just see. It just comes down to time because I love doing the Paranormal Sun. I love bringing these things to you, but it does take a good bit of time to, you know, gather all the information, do the research, do the recording, do the editing, manage the social media. Folks, if you've never done a podcast and you've never really done one like this, you know, I'm not doing 10 or 20 minute segments. And on top of that, like I say, running the social media and everything else is really a full-time job. So again, thank you so much for your support. And with all of that said, folks, I do, like I say, I thank you so much for everyone out there in the world that takes the time to get back to me. If there's something that you would like to hear on the program, if there's a story that you'd like to tell, or there's a topic you'd like to cover, you'd like me to cover over, just send me an email at theparanormalsun@gmail.com, and I will be happy to cover it over for you. My backlog of content is several hundred episodes of, you know, content or topics, and all I have to do really is slide it around. I only have about the next four or five at any one time planned. Now, folks, before I get into the news of the dam, there's one other thing that I just wanted to briefly mention. For years and years, I've enjoyed a free product called LibriVox Recordings. And these recordings, I remember even when I was in school, we used to get to listen to them on tape sometimes. And this is basically a free reading of books that are in the public domain. So, for example, I've enjoyed over and over many times the different H.P. Lovecraft works that you can find on YouTube that are recorded as LibriVox recordings. That means they're in the public domain and you can listen to them for free. They can be uploaded, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I didn't realize that, you know, this is all basically a volunteer organization. And, you know, they've obviously done a lot of good work for the blind, especially before audiobooks when it wasn't so easy to get your hands on recorded books. Well, I've gone over and signed up at LibriVox, and, you know, you can sign up to be a proof listener, so you listen to what other people have recorded just to see if there are any major mistakes, and you can also do book readings, and so at some point, I will probably be recording books over there. I just feel it's a good charity to give my time to. It's something I enjoy doing, and, you know, so if you get a chance and it's something you're interested, you know, by all means, go over there and check out LibriVox. And, you know, I've been thinking about it for quite a while about recording some of these public domain books or works and either uploading them, you know, onto the show or maybe a different show or just onto YouTube. So if it's something that you'd be interested in hearing, you know, by all means, just let me know and I'll be happy to try and fit it into the show. Now, with all that having been said, you might have just heard a little bit of noise over here. I've got a very special co-host this evening. So, William, who is basically the mascot for Tower Studios, The Fortunate Son, and The Paranormal Son, is in the studio here with me. So, you know, he's a VIP. Lately, with the weather and the fireworks for Guy Fawkes Day, William has not had a great time of being left alone. So he's perched up right next to me as I record this episode. Now, for those of you who may be new to The Paranormal Son, each week I try to bring you some articles that are interesting and in this realm, and I titled this segment, The News of the Damned. Now, The News of the Damned is an homage to Charles Fort. Charles Fort was one of the first people who, back in the early 1900s, started gathering a lot of this information from newspaper cuttings and magazines all over the world, and then collating the information into books and publishing it so that you and I and future generations could, you know, enjoy it and see that this phenomena is not something that started in 1947, you know, with UFOs and other things. I mean, he covered ghost ships, he covered sea serpents, all sorts of things. Well, anyway, anything that was an excluded story or an excluded example by science, so something that science couldn't explain and oftentimes just ignored, he called damned data. Therefore, this segment is always called The News of the Damned. Now, on tonight's News of the Damned, we've got a couple of just very quick bonus points that I wanted to read out. The first one was that one of the show's longtime listeners and biggest helps in San Antonio, Adriana and Nico, sent me a video earlier of a purported Sasquatch sighted in British Columbia. Now, I will put a link in the show notes so you can go over and have a look. My thoughts on it are that I won't say it's impossible, but they got awfully close to this creature. And if this was really a Sasquatch, from everything I've heard, you know, they're quite attuned to their surroundings. So either this person was a ninja, or they had a lot higher zoom on the camera than it looks like from the footage. Again, it's not really clear, but I mean, looking, judging it, you know, it doesn't look like they're any more than about 20 or 30 feet away. It is interesting, and I would encourage you to go and check it out. And again, you know, is it fair or foul? Is it fake or real? That decision is up to you, as always, on the Paranormal Sun. And the other, you know, bonus part of the News of the Damned again is the fourth part of the U-196 saga that I've been covering. Now, I actually got someone who reached out to me and basically said, oh, this is bunk, it's crap, why are you covering it? Well, as I say, I leave that up to you as the listeners. I realize there's not a whole lot of proof to this U-196 story or theory. However, there are a lot of very odd things that happened with the Third Reich during World War II and after the war. Now, again, I tend not to go too far into depth about what I think or what I feel, because I leave that up to you. But I will tell you that in the grand list of different conspiracy theories, if you said to me, oh, JT, where do you put, you know, kind of some of this Third Reich stuff? So, you know, major top-level Nazis escaped after the war and they didn't necessarily die as we were told. You know, secret Nazi technology continuing on after the war, Nazi bases outside of Germany. I would put that in the very upper echelon of conspiracy theories that I do believe in, at least partially. So take that as you will. I'm not trying to steer you in any direction. But, you know, again, folks, do your own research. And in future, I will be doing more shows about these kind of topics. It is fascinating to me as a student of history. It is quite interesting. So I'll get to that fourth segment of the U-196 story after I finish your three articles for tonight. So the first one here, folks, is quite an interesting one. And this is a bit more of a history's mysteries thing than UFOs or anything else. Now, this one is from coasttocoastam.com, and this one is titled Century-Old Carrier Pigeon Message Found in France. So this is by Tim Banal, and again, longtime listeners of the show, you will realize that pretty much everything from Coast to Coast is bylined by Tim Banal. So it says, a couple hiking in France stumbled upon a remarkable relic from the past in the form of a carrier pigeon message that had been sent over a century ago. The amazing discovery was reportedly made back in September by Jade Halloui and his partner as they were walking in the field in community Ingersheim, which is located in the northeastern part of the country. And again, from the Germanic name, I was going to say, I figured it'd be close to the German border. As they trudged through some tall grass, they noticed a curious capsule sticking out of the ground. Intrigued by the odd sight, Halloui unearthed the small metal cylinder, cracked it open, and found a handwritten message in a language that they did not understand. In the hopes of determining the nature of the puzzling note, they brought it to a nearby museum, and the curator of the facility, Dominique Jardy, immediately recognized it as being penned in an outdated form of the German language. The message was eventually translated and revealed to be observations about military operations occurring in the area around the time just before the start of World War I. Due to the manner in which the note was written, it is uncertain when exactly the message was penned, but it is believed to be from either 1910 or 1916. Marveling at the impeccable condition of the century-old paper, Jardy marveled that I've never seen this in 40 years, and called the discovery exceptional. As one might imagine, the message and the capsule which contained it will go on display at a museum in the not-too-distant future after it has been studied further by historians. Yeah, folks, so again, when you're out walking, look down. If you see odd things, have a look. I mean, there have been multiple stories that I've heard of over the years of people discovering everything from lost treasures to bones, all kinds of interesting things. So if you're out there walking around, folks, make sure you have a look down. Now, the next article here is also from coasttocoastam.com, and this has got a video in it. And this one says, video, Irish farmer cursed by toppled standing stone, enlists druids for help. Now, folks, for those of you who may not be familiar with Ireland and, you know, the UK in general, and a lot of these standing stones, it has long been believed that if you fiddle with these standing stones, if you desecrate them in any way, tip them over, move them, it will lay a curse on you. And there have been stories about people, you know, saying, oh, I'm not afraid of it, moving these standing stones, and then not long after getting sick and dying. And I've read multiple stories of these over the years. So now we'll get into it. An Irish farmer beset with bad luck for the last 10 years, 10 years, man, believes that his misfortunes were caused by an ancient standing stone, which was knocked over on his property. And as such, he enlists a pair of druids to help him correct the problem. According to a local media report, Donald Bohane has continuously seen his fields flooded and his cattle stricken with illness over the last decade. At his wit's end over the ongoing difficulties, the farmer wondered what could have sparked the proverbial dark cloud hanging over his farm and recalled a fateful day in which one of his bulls toppled a standing stone on the property. I look back and everything traces back to that incident about 10 years ago, Bohane mused. The Bronze Age stone had been used as a property marker and is believed to have likely had some kind of religious or spiritual significance in the distant past. Desperate to make things right with whatever forces were disturbed by the downed relic, Bohane turned to a folklore professor for advice, and she put him in touch with druids Jan and Karen Teteru, who ventured out to his farm to investigate the matter. The duo determined that the standing stone had probably fallen across a fairy road, and in turn upset the elemental beings coexisting with Bohane on the property. While that explanation may sound fantastic to some, the pair pointed to numerous instances where residents constructed on similar magical spots caused all manner of misfortune until ultimately being raised in response. As such, the druids brought in a digger, which was used to set the stone back into its proper place, and they then performed a series of rituals. Over the course of 2 hours, to clear the spirit road of energy or energy line of any blockage and to put an end to the misfortune cast upon the cattle using the field. So again, folks, hey, we each have our own beliefs, and I'm sure many of you might be listening and go, you know, might be saying, oh, bunk, yeah, I don't believe in that. But I'll tell you what, 10 years of bad luck, I would rather err on the side of caution. It's not that hard to do what this, in my mind, really intelligent farmer did. Now, on to the third article here. Now, this one has got a New Zealand slant. And I didn't know about this one until I saw it on Coast to Coast AM. That's why I go to this website, because they collate stories from all over the internet, and I find it really awesome. Now, you know, as you know, I've not long ago covered the Kaikoura Lights episode, and this has got a tie into it. So there's a photo here, and it's pretty cool looking. It says, rare UFO house for sale in New Zealand. An incredibly rare Futuro house has been put up for sale in New Zealand, where less than 10 of the flying saucer-shaped residences exist. The brainchild of Finnish architect Mari Surin, approximately 100 of the homes were constructed over the course of the 60s and 70s. Since that time, a great number of the houses have fallen into disrepair, making the remaining residences something of an expensive collector's item, with some becoming roadside attractions, and one in California being transformed into an Airbnb. This particular Futuro house is reportedly located in the city of Christchurch. So folks, that's in South Island, and Christchurch, if you'll remember from the Kaikoura Lights, that is where the Argosy was flying to and back from. It's the largest city in South Island, and I've been there a few times myself. So it's located in the city of Christchurch and has been displayed at various sites throughout the city over the last 14 years. For fans of the famed residences, the home serves as something of a museum, as it contains a number of placards detailing the history of the odd buildings. Although there is no listed asking price for the UFO house, an initial estimate placed the value at around $200,000, though the price could climb considerably higher given the rarity of the residence as well as its pristine condition. And folks, looking at it, it does look like it's in pretty darn good condition. And again, you know, there'll be a link in the show notes, so you can go over and check that out if you would like. But, you know, it looks like just pretty much what you would think of when you think of what somebody in the 60s or 70s would design as a futuristic UFO-looking house. Now, folks, with those articles out of the way, we will now be getting into the fourth part of the U-196 saga. So here we are with the U-196 Part 4, and it says, the story so far, according to an American researcher writing in Science magazine in 1978, Japan's nuclear efforts were disrupted in April 1945 when a B-29 raid damaged Nishina's thermal diffusion separation apparatus. Some reports claim the Japanese subsequently moved their atomic operations to Konan, or Hungnam, now part of North Korea. The Japanese may have used this facility for making small quantities of heavy water. The Japanese plant was captured by Soviet troops at the war's end, and some reports claim that the output of the Hungnam plant was collected every other month by Soviet submarines. Dönitz ordered the return of all Gruppen Monsoon U-boats from the Pacific towards the end of January 1945, when defeat became inevitable. There appears reason to believe the U-196 was ordered south from Korea and directed to land her cargo and research team evacuees in Northland, New Zealand. They were immediately assigned to build the necessary machinery to continue their nuclear research. There is a prevailing intelligence-sponsored myth claiming the Germans were so completely disorganized by internal rivalries, they managed to derail most of their important weapons projects. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, German counterintelligence was so effective, many of the projects disclosed to the Allies after the surrender were unsuspected or beyond the understanding of most Allied technical teams. These projects became what the Americans have termed deep black, never to be revealed at any cost, nor subject to budgetary scrutiny by Congress or Parliament. These are the facts we know. Type IXD-2 Gruppe Monsoon U-boat deployments at the end of the war. U-234, front boat of the 33rd Flotilla, departed Kristiansand, Norway on April 16, 1945, commanded by K.L. Feller, bound for Kobe, Japan. It carried 10 German and 2 Japanese passengers. Cargo was loaded at Kiel in January and February 1945, and the boat sailed. The U-234 entered Plymouth Naval Yard, New Hampshire, on May 17, 1945, with 560 kilograms of uranium oxide in gold-lined containers. Specific handling instructions were given to Falk, and a Lieutenant Pfaff was responsible for loading the boat. On May 24, 1945, when the Navy began unloading the U-234, there had been no decision to use the atom bomb. On May 30th, both the Secretary of State Stimson and President Truman were agreed no alternative existed but to do so. Lieutenant Colonel John Lansdale, Chief of Security for the Manhattan Project, wrote in 1996 that he personally handled the disposal of the 10 cases from the U-234 and stated the American military authorities reacted with panic when they learned what the containers contained. In Pfaff's interrogation report, he stated that the cylinders could be safely handled like TNT, but if opened, the material inside became sensitive and dangerous if exposed to air. No nuclear physicist has been able to deliver an opinion as to what the substance in the cylinders was and why it required such extraordinary precautions. British Intelligence Operatives Subcommittee Final Report, 142 grams. Information obtained from targets of opportunity in the Sonhofen area, HMSO London. The report states, during 1944, an explosive mixture of 60% liquid air and 40% finely powdered coal dust, invented by Dr. Mario Zippemayer, was tested at Doberitz Explosives Ground near Berlin and found to be very destructive over a radius of 600 meters. Waffen-SS scientists then became involved and added some kind of waxy substance to the explosive. The bombs had to be filled immediately prior to the aircraft taking off. Bombs of 25 kilos and 50 kilos were dropped on the Starnberger Sea and photos taken. Standartenfuhrer Klemm showed these to Brandt, Hitler's scientific advisor. The intensive explosion covered an area of up to 4.5 kilometers. This waxy substance was a reagent of some kind, which was said to interact with air during the development of the explosion. causing it to change its composition and so create meteorological change in the atmosphere. Lightning storms at ground level consumed all available oxygen. Goering's statement upon his arrest in May 1945 is significant. He claimed to have led a revolt against Luftwaffe use of the bomb, which would have destroyed all civilization. The bomb was not a nuclear weapon, and it appears to have been a conventional explosive, which used a reagent or catalyst produced by Tesla methodology or similar for its inexplicable effect. Now, folks, just to give you a bit of a background on that, basically there is a theory that has gone around in some people's alternate explanations of what happened during World War II, how advanced the German technology was and everything else, that basically the Germans invented the fuel air bomb long before the Americans and others used it. Now, for those of you that don't know about a lot about warfare and munitions, a fuel air bomb is an extremely powerful bomb. It's the next step down from an atomic bomb, basically. It's extremely destructive. And if you drop a fuel air bomb in, let's say, a bunker, if it gets close enough and the bunker is not sealed, it will basically suck all of the air out of the bunker and basically suffocate the soldiers inside. So as you can imagine, this is quite a destructive weapon. And I've heard stories of this before. I've read different accounts. And there were claims that the Russians basically sent a telegram using an intermediary country, I believe it was Sweden, to basically tell the Germans if they did not stop using these weapons, they were going to use poison gas in retaliation. So again, oftentimes with these things from World War II, there's just a little bit, you know, of information out there or a little bit of facts. And this is what annoys a lot of people because they feel, well, there's no facts to prove this one way or the other. But nevertheless, like I say, whether you believe it or not, I find it quite fascinating. Now, carrying on here. So, top secret reports. April 27, 1945, SHAPE headquarters. For the eyes of General Marshall and the War Minister of Eisenhower's special ALSOS mission, led by Boris Pasch and collaborating with the task force of 6th Army Group, have found the jackpot in the area of Hickinger and have found personal information and materials that exceeds their wildest expectations. The full details will be communicated later by the usual secret channels, but we have no doubt that everything, although nothing, was known of that information. Biography of Dr. Boris Pasch, ALSOS Team Europe. Furthermore, a top secret report entitled Engine Interference Countermeasures, addressed to the Air Technical Services Command, U.S. Air Force, Wright Field, Dayton, Ohio. Now, that's interesting in and of itself because Wright Field is the base that it's claimed the bodies from Roswell and several other UFO crashes went to. The OSS appears to be involved in identifying the source of the interference, which they claimed was in the Frankfurt, Maine region. The report states, an influencing with conventional aircraft, however incredible it might appear, to project from the ground to a height of 30,000 feet, sufficient magnetic energy to interfere with the functioning of the ignition system of an airplane. It must be concluded that the enemy not only intends to interfere with our aircraft by some immaterial means, but also succeeded in accomplishing this intention. So now, carrying on with that U-196 part, it says, it is therefore completely reasonable to assume, given the last known position of U-196, that it was in transit from the Japanese nuclear research facility in Hungnam, North Korea, with technicians and materials needed for the manufacture of a Bell centrifugal device. We have also been informed that upon its arrival, the scientific party was instructed to immediately begin work on a nuclear bomb fuse device, something that would have required Zerum-525, which we now understand the U-196 was probably carrying in gold-lined cylinders. We have established there were a number of U-boats in transit to locations around the world. U-530 was in transit to Montevideo, Uruguay, U-234 to New York, and U-862 in transit from Batavia in Indonesia to Germany on February the 15th, 1945. There were also some 20 type XXI U-boats, the very latest electro boats, unaccounted for at the end of the war. All the Monsoon group of boats are known to have been carrying uranium oxide or mercury in special containers. Admiral Dönitz, appointed head of state by Hitler in late April 1945 before he allegedly committed suicide, and SS General Hans Kammler, in charge of the SS nuclear program, had determined they would spread the remaining nuclear research as far across the globe as practicable, in order to ensure one such site would survive and continue the work suspended by the end of hostilities. Facilities were established in Argentina, Uruguay, North Korea, Australia, and New Zealand. Again, because of the lack of precise details, we must draw our conclusions from the available circumstantial evidence. It was originally believed the U-196 equipment had been brought ashore and set up in a disused dairy factory, having the electrical and water supplies necessary for the project. But as research deepened, this appeared unlikely. What the Germans had discovered during the Bell operations was the necessity for deep underground shielding from the intense electromagnetic radiation surrounding the working Bell. This electromagnetic field was something not well understood in 1945, even though Tesla had been experimenting with such phenomena since the 1890s. The German technicians understood the extreme dangers associated with the unexpected fluctuations that could occur and were still perfecting their control techniques. This possibly explains the five German graves discovered sometime in the 1980s. Something happened during the operation of the Bell, resulting in their deaths. Of equal interest was the reaction of the authorities. Nothing, given they were foreign nationals and essentially prisoners of war. Their deaths would be ignored with little risk of discovery. All burials apparently occurred in remote graves somewhere in Northland. It would also be chance. One grave was discovered, revealing the occupant to be German, according to the clothing remains discovered. So with the problem of shielding large amounts of EM radiation, where could the project be housed? Army Bay Fangaparoa seemed the logical place. It was isolated, under complete military control, contained deep ammunition and command bunkers, and an independent electrical system. It also had a radar post to warn of shipping that might stray too close. Just as importantly, it had seawater for decontamination. Late in 1945 or early 1946, there was an unexplained, very large explosion in or near Army Bay. Like other similar events, it was attributed to a sea mine or some such other large explosive device the Army may have wished to dispose of, but no such event had been reported. There were several mines detonated off Whangarei Heads during the war, but they were some distance from Army Bay. So Whangarei and Army Bay, it is quite a while, folks. It'd be quite a distance. I mean, I think that's about, it'd be over 100 kilometers, which is, you know, over 60, 70 miles. So what could it have been? Perhaps it was the Army testing Zerum 525, which had been brought ashore in gold-lined cylinders as part of the U-196 nuclear materials consignment. Zerum 525 is believed to have been part of the initiator for the nuclear weapons detonator. It was particularly dangerous to handle once exposed to air. There is New Zealand Archives film of a test explosion at Army Bay in 1945, which looks suspiciously like such a test. Or could it have been a sonic boom created by a time wave? The dawning of a new age. But there was more. During the operation of the Bell, it required very precise control over the time the unit operated. Most spins lasted between 1 and 3 minutes, never longer. The reason for this has not been fully explained, but it is assumed the electromagnetic field became uncontrollable as the ceramic disc plates accelerated from 5,000 to 50,000 RPMs. Very few German manufacturers could meet such specifications, as Victor Schauberger was to discover when building his first flying disc in 1942. The runtimes were monitored with high-precision stopwatches, both from within and outside the electromagnetic fields. The Germans noticed the difference between the two readings and immediately recognized they had created a time displacement effect. That is, there was a measurable difference between time measured within the electromagnetic fields, close to the Bell, and those outside of the fields. They also understood theoretically they had created an anti-gravity field, although this would have been difficult to measure around the Bell. What could be measured, or what could be achieved by this project, were three distinct yet parallel outcomes. Nuclear fissionable material for the British nuclear weapons program, now hastily moved to Australia and predominantly led by German researchers, brought in immediately after the war, a gravitational displacement field project based on the work of Schauberger, and most importantly, an exploration of time dilation fields. Each of these projects could have been hermetically sealed. as they had been by the Kommandostab in Germany and later in America for NASA. It was a matter of compartmentalizing the data streams. Why this location in New Zealand? Surely there must have been an equally suitable number of other secure locations, even further away from a major city such as Auckland. Yes, that's true, but there weren't any located close to what have been called ley lines, vital for increasing the efficiency of these experiments. Hence the reason for the Argentine, Uruguay, Australian, and Northland locations. They all occupied a primary ley line. So what is a ley line? Ley lines are those mysterious places on the planet where particularly strong electromagnetic fields break through the Earth's crust and often cause anomalous physical phenomena such as levitation of rocks and physical effects on humans, such as nausea, vomiting, and headaches. Sometimes only certain species of plants can survive near them. Probably the most famous is Stonehenge in England. Yet this massive stone structure is not unique. Similar structures exist all over the globe, built by largely unknown civilizations before the dawn of our era. All occupy ley lines. The Germans, through the Vril and Thule societies, had explored this phenomenon since the late 19th century. Both groups attracted some of Germany's best scientific minds, dedicated to understanding this force of nature. It was from these groups the SS Kommandostab secretly recruited to develop the most advanced scientific programs known to mankind. Both the Vril and Thule societies shared a common philosophy, the exploration of the natural forces of the universe, but their most important achievement was to train researchers to look at problems outside the paradigm of the 1890s. It mattered not if the researcher was a PhD in physics or a talented amateur. Their experience was considered to be of equal value. Expertise was considered to be of equal value. Max Planck may have been a brilliant mathematician, but Victor Schauberger, an apparently simple Austrian forester, saw problems of fluid dynamics that had eluded everyone. And that's true, folks. I remember reading about what Schauberger invented, and it was pretty far out that someone who was, you know, basically a lumberjack or a forester, you know, and basically solved a problem that all of these brilliant minds could not. Even Ernst Haeckel was forced to ask for help in completing the design of the Haeckel HS-8 jet turbine after stealing the design concept from Schauberger's patent covering water turbines. So it's saying that even Haeckel had to ask for help from Schauberger. Once the British scientific research teams had begun to appreciate the significance of the Kommandostab expertise, the sky suddenly became the limit, literally. They soon realized the Russians would also possess such a weapon, and a general paranoia descended over the military as the scientists began to explore the damage inflicted on Japan by the two bombs. New Zealand willingly joined its British Empire colleagues as they faced a nuclear-armed Russia and a former ally, the U.S., now determined to deny them access to future nuclear research. Is U-196 the missing link to greater things? Okay, folks, so that is the end of part four, and I'm just going to give you a very brief overview because that took us quickly down a rabbit hole. Now, lucky for you, I am an expert at navigating this rabbit hole. One of the things I don't like about this article, to be brutally honest, is the way that they write in very factual tones. I'm not saying that it's not possible or it couldn't be true, but they're writing this as though this is 100% proven fact, okay? And oftentimes this is how people attack these fields that I enjoy, things like UFOs or cryptids or what. They basically call it a pseudoscience, and that's one of the things that they point out is, you know, that people weave fact and fiction together to make it look like it's all true. Look, I've heard all of those claims before, except for the part about them setting up these things in Australia and New Zealand. And it is fascinating to me. All I'm saying, folks, is take it with a grain of salt. We've got no proof that this is actually what happened. Now, again, the Bell has become quite famous. It's got a tie-in with Keksberg. Many people have covered this over, and at some point, I probably will. You know, again, some of those Nazis that vanished after the war that were deep involved in this, look, the Nazis definitely had black weapons projects. That's true. In my mind, 100% true. The SS was a force unto itself in the Third Reich. The further and further they got into the war, the SS just basically became a splinter group that did things their way and they did what they wanted to, because who was really going to put them in check? Okay. No one really. I mean, Heinrich Himmler was in charge of the SS and he only reported to Hitler basically. And, you know, the SS basically did what it wanted. But those compartmentalized black projects, okay, that is how you would do it. Like in this, that's what they're saying. If there were these three effects, this time dilation, the, you know, potential of making basically fuel for nuclear weapons, and I can't, and the time dilation, I think I said that. Anyway, those three effects, you would tend to compartmentalize those so that no one knew about all three. And again, you would only work on your little section. So nonetheless, folks, we've just got one more part of that story to go through. Again, I'm sorry for anyone who might be sitting out there listening to this going, oh, what a bunch of BS, okay? Again, things like this, oftentimes, as I say, truth is mixed with unsubstantiated claims. I nonetheless find it interesting. And as I said, I've never heard of these five dead bodies in Northland, these five Germans, but I would be asking, why were they here? You know, where did these bodies come from? Why were there Germans here, you know, from the war? I highly doubt it was someone like a backpacker or somebody who came here on holiday, because you wouldn't just go bury them out in the middle of nowhere. So anyway, folks, next week we'll cover the last part of that, and then we'll move on to something else. And with that, we're now going to get into the fascinating and the intriguing Stephenville Light phenomenon. On the afternoon of January the 9th, 2008, Ken Cherry, the 61-year-old owner of a prosperous Tarrant County, Texas securities firm, was sitting in his home office. Ken was studying various stock market reports, flitting across his computer screen, when line 2 rang. Line 1 is devoted to customers and brokers. Line 2 is the UFO phone. Cherry is the Texas State Director of the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON, the country's oldest and largest UFO investigation group. He supervises a staff of 41 certified MUFON investigators in the state. These men and women spend their free time interviewing people who have written into the MUFON website or called one of its numbers, claiming to have seen a UFO. In an average month, the Texas chapter of MUFON receives between 15 and 20 such reports. Most of them sound like what Cherry heard on January the 9th. A woman outside Stephenville, 70 miles southwest of Fort Worth, said she and her teenage son had seen some flashing lights in the sky the previous evening. Cherry asked a few questions and hung up. Since the woman had described seeing the lights for only a few seconds, he didn't figure this would be anything other than a typical sighting. Then line 2 rang again. A Stephenville man was calling to say that he had seen something strange the night before. A single bright light hovering over the treetops near his home. Curious, Cherry logged into the MUFON website, where he saw several reports waiting for him, all from residents of the Stephenville area who had seen strange lights on the night of January the 8th. The next day, Cherry read a front-page story in the Stephenville Empire Tribune about four more area residents who had seen something in the sky on January the 8th. One of them was Steve Allen, the president and owner of a trucking company in the nearby town of Glen Rose. Allen also happens to be a licensed pilot. Comfortable with judging aircraft and flight patterns from the ground, and what he described nearly took Cherry's breath away. Flashing lights covering a distance of a mile in length and half a mile in width at an altitude of about 3,500 feet. The lights, Allen said, were totally silent and had been racing around the sky at about 3,000 miles an hour, until they suddenly turned into burning flames, white in color. Within seconds, the flames had disappeared and there was nothing left to see. But approximately 10 minutes later, the lights reappeared, this time traveling to the east. Allen added, two military jets, possibly F-16s, were in pursuit. Allen said it took the UFO just a few seconds to cross a section of the sky that it takes him 20 minutes to fly in his Cessna. Allen was at a campfire with friends and said, I don't know if it was a biblical experience or somebody from a different universe or whatever, but it was definitely not from around these parts. It came within a mile of us, said Allen, the owner of L&S Enterprises and Texas Freight, a local trucking company. It flipped us all out. Allen would later draw a sketch of the object, which, as I've covered, he said traveled at amazing speed without making a sound. While drawing, Allen said that he saw an arch shape converted into a vertical shape, and then it split and made two of them, and then these turned into just fire, and it was gone. It looked like something firing up, like a blowtorch, Alan said. It simply vanished. 10 minutes later, the group saw the lights coming from the opposite direction, trailing them closely. Alan was certain were two military jets, followed by two massive red orbs. Alan, who as a licensed pilot was comfortable at judging these distances again, said that the lights were about 3,000 feet above the ground. He went home and he told his wife, who urged him to keep the encounter to himself. Alan spent a sleepless night, enthralled by what he had seen. In the morning, he contacted the Empire Tribune. His call went to education reporter Angelina Joyner, who knew nothing about UFOs, but Alan sounded like a sensible man. He was a pilot and seemed very intelligent, said Joyner, a 47-year-old former school teacher who had been a reporter for 18 months at the time. Alan's friends confirmed the account. Still, it was a strange story, and Joyner's bosses were concerned. Managing editor Sarah Vandenberg said she was so anxious that she cried the next morning when she saw a UFO in the headline. Everyone is laughing at us, she thought. That was before the television crews started showing up. First came the local reporters, then people from Good Morning America, NPR, and CNN. Joyner doubted the weird pattern of lights reported by Alan and others could be explained by military aircraft. Alan wasn't buying it either. Our military wishes it had what we saw, he said. Cherry walked out of his office and down the hall to find his wife. Who's the operations manager for his security business? And answers line two when he's not there. Dear, he said, we might be on to something big. The Stephenville event, as some have called it, has become one of the most publicized UFO sightings in a decade. The story showed up in newspapers as far away as China. CNN's Larry King devoted two shows to what it all meant. Do you believe alien beings are out there? King teased, staring intently at the camera, forehead glistening. Do you believe they've come to Earth? Predictably, there have been plenty of jokes and marketing gimmicks. Stephenville began advertising its upcoming rodeo as out of this world, but most locals were more than a little spooked by what took place in the night sky. One eyewitness wondered if he was watching the end of the world. To add to the mystery, Major Carl Lewis, a spokesman for the 301st Fighter Wing at the Naval Air Station Joint Reserve Base, Fort Worth, when asked whether any of his planes could have been involved, initially declared that none of the base's jets had been operating around Stephenville that night. He glibly told reporters that what people had seen was probably nothing more than an illusion caused by two commercial airplanes and the setting sun. But a week later, after more citizens kept coming forward to report that they too had seen rapidly moving lights that could not possibly have been caused by an ordinary airplane, Air Force officials released a terse press release admitting that 10 F-16 fighter jets had been training in the area on January the 8th. When reporters asked what the jets had been doing, Lewis cryptically stated, "What we do down there falls under operational procedures that cannot be released because of operation security for our mission." Yeah, well, you know, that's pretty obvious when first there were no planes in the area and now there are. Now we don't want to tell you what they're doing. Meanwhile, sightings were continuing to pour into the MUFON website. One man wrote that he had watched three distinct sets of lights for about 5 minutes. Another witness saw strobing lights. A man who had been driving with his daughter from Eastland reported, "We spotted two large bright lights like stars. The two lights moved towards each other very, very fast. They looked like they met, and then five or six smaller lights dispersed out in a circular pattern away from them, and then everything was just gone." What were those lights? And what were those F-16s doing? For Cherry and his investigators, the answer to these questions has become their holy grail. It's maybe a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to solve a mystery, he says. Are those lights from some secret military aircraft? Or did they come from somewhere else? And if they did come from somewhere else, then what does the government know? To be honest with you, I wasn't all that interested in UFOs until I visited that UFO museum in Roswell back in 1991, Cherry says with a chuckle, referring to the New Mexico town where the military reportedly attempted to cover up a 1947 UFO crash. It was just a little amateur museum, but it did get me thinking that maybe the government knew more than they were telling us. This led him to join the 3,000-member MUFON, which is based in Fort Collins, Colorado. Soon he was named the head of the Texas operations. For his lead Texas investigator, Cherry chose Steve Hudgens, a burly project manager for a Fort Worth glass installation company who shares Cherry's no-nonsense attitude. "Believe me, I'm not a big believer in all that paranormal X-Files kind of stuff. I only do this because I've wanted to know for a long, long time if these supposed UFO sightings are real or just made up," says Hudgens. Since receiving his investigator certification in 1992, he was required to pass a lengthy test based on the 311-page MUFON Field Investigator's Manual. Hudgens estimates that he has looked into more than 2,000 accounts of UFO sightings in Texas. And to be honest with you, he says, I have at once finished an investigation where I could say for certain that someone had seen a genuine UFO. 90% of the cases I get are explainable, the result of somebody seeing an unusual cloud formation or taking a photo with a bug on the camera lens. The other reports I get are tantalizing, but the people have no evidence whatsoever to prove what they saw. I'm a nuts and bolts guy. If I can't prove something unidentifiable was up there, then I move on to the next case. When the reports began flooding in from Stephenville area in January 2008, Hudgens knew he was about to embark on a different kind of investigation altogether. Here we had hundreds of unrelated witnesses, solid salt-of-the-earth folks, spread out over three or four counties, all saying they had seen something. And as I say, folks, as I've covered on this program time and time again, people in these rural areas are not going to just go around saying they saw strange things in the sky if they didn't, because it not only affects your standing in the community, but oftentimes your livelihood. I mean, I've heard of cases many times where people are let go from jobs because their businesses feel that they're not trustworthy if they see things in the sky. Hudgens and Cherry sent word to the news media that they would be setting up at a Rotary Club hall in Dublin, about 10 miles away from Stephenville, to interview anyone in the area who had seen the lights. On the appointed day, more than 500 people arrived. Many of those, it turned out, had come simply to be a part of the hoopla. A couple of teenagers showed up wearing hats made out of tinfoil. Some other teenagers sold t-shirts that read, Stephenville, the new Roswell. Cheerful Rotarians passed out free popcorn and Dr. Pepper. At least 50 members of the media milled around, interviewing anyone who would talk to them. But by the end of the day, more than 200 citizens had come forward, completely swamping the 8 MUFON investigators, who had brought only 50 questionnaires. There were certainly a few with some extreme claims. One elderly man declared that aliens had abducted him in the 60s. Another said his television was on the fritz because of UFO interference and asked the investigators if they could repair UFO damaged sets. Still, the number of legitimate-sounding reports was so high, ultimately MUFON collected around 200 accounts from the Stephenville area, and they were coming from such credible sources, everyone from a county constable to an anesthesiologist, that Cherry and Hudgens quickly realized that the Stephenville event was going to be the biggest mass UFO sighting in the U.S. since the 1997 Phoenix Lights. What was especially curious to Cherry and Hudgens was that the sightings had taken place over a series of days. It was very intense bright lights, said local newspaper reporter Angela Joyner. Constable Leroy Gatlin saw the brilliant red orbs hovering in the sky and hollered for his family to come outside. It's probably an airplane, said his wife Wendy, who didn't budge from the couch. Only his 8-year-old son Ryan went to the front yard. That's a UFO, the boy said. Gatlin, who had spent 16 years patrolling the Texas scrubland, faced a bit of a dilemma. With an election coming up, he could tell the world of this incredible sight and look like an idiot, or keep his mouth shut. People would say, hey, this guy is nuts. He's crazy, said Gatlin of his sighting January the 8th. In the morning, there was no unusual police reports, leaving him to wonder whether anyone else had seen the lights. But the next day, the Stephenville Empire Tribune came out with that front page story, possible UFO sighting. 4 area residents witnessed mysterious objects. The lights were going like this, said Gateman, making hand gestures to describe what he saw when he spotted the UFO. Gaten said that he was walking to his car when he saw a red glow that reminded him of pictures he'd seen of an erupting volcano. He said the object was suspended about 3,000 feet in the air. Gaten said he was so awestruck that he called his son to come and see, but he didn't talk much about the sighting until he saw that story about the UFO in the local paper. It was so fast I couldn't track it with my binoculars, he said. He reasoned from the presence of the F-16s that he probably had seen a military experiment the Air Force wouldn't fully disclose. We're in the middle of a war right now, he said. Because again, folks, in 2008, you know, the U.S. was in Afghanistan and Iraq. And not that they've completely left, but, you know, that's oftentimes what these witnesses feel, is that they're seeing technology being tested. One of the more flabbergasting accounts, however, came from a Dublin machinist and welder named Ricky Sorrells, and it dated about a week or more before the majority of the reports. Sorrels told MUFON's investigators that he had been out hunting at dusk when he saw a giant gray object in the sky, 3 football fields in length. He'd looked through the scope of his rifle and noticed that the bottom of the object had no rivets, nuts, or bolts. It did have cone-shaped holes embedded in the surface. The object hovered 300 feet in the air over the tree canopy, then took off at a terrific rate of speed. Sorrels has later claimed that military helicopters have since overflown his property at low altitude and that he has been getting strange phone calls. He also claims that an unknown man came to his door. After Sorrels continually asked the man to leave and he wouldn't, he grabbed his rifle. The man then told him, "Son, we have the same caliber weapons you have, but we have a hell of a lot more of them. And you need to shut your mouth about what you saw. I'm trying to decide whether or not to open the door," Sorrels said. "We're just standing there face to face looking at each other. I'm thinking he's dressed for the elements, and the dogs are raising such a ruckus he must know he's in danger of being caught. That's when I realized he wanted me to see him." The man then turned away and walked into the woods. Initially, the problem for the MUFON investigators was that no one had gotten a clear photo or snippet of video. But in early February, Cherry and Hudgens made an unpublicized trip to Stephenville to view a 13-minute home movie that had been shot by a man standing on his front porch on the east side of town. During the first round of hoopla, the man had not gone public with the video because he didn't want to be besieged by UFO fanatics. "Our experts haven't had a chance to study what he shot in great detail," says Cherry, "but all I can say is that I've never seen anything like it. It's completely unexplainable. The light's constantly changing color and shape every couple of seconds as they move from one part of the sky to another, like some sort of hieroglyphics. Some of the shapes are scorpion-like, other shapes are worm-like, and even more shapes are like circles. And believe me, the man who shot the video is not sophisticated enough to have faked the footage. He's like just about everyone else out in that part of the state. A respectable, decent, salt-of-the-earth Texan who, up until this moment, thought the whole UFO phenomenon was just for kooks." Hudgens and Cherry warn, however, that despite its singularity, the video is not the great smoking gun that will finally convince even the most hardened UFO skeptics. "If the video showed some sort of craft behind those lights," Cherry said, "like maybe a craft 3 football fields in size, then this would be a whole different ballgame. The most talked about event in the world." MUFON study. On January 8, 2008, people in Stephenville, Texas reported the largest UFO sighting in the U.S. since the Phoenix Lights in 1997. Now, the UFO investigative organization MUFON released a 77-page report a few months later on the sighting. The MUFON report was entitled Special Research Report Stephenville, Texas, and it was written by Glenn Schultz and Robert Powell. Schultz in the 1950s received a special Army commendation for upgrading missile tracking antenna sites for the White Sands Proving Grounds. The following decade, he delivered a revelation to America's intelligence agencies by recording Soviet radar signals bouncing off the moon's surface into receivers on Antigua. Schultz went on to specialize in the radar return analysis of air traffic accident investigations and has been called an expert witness by law firms handling aviation litigation. Powell has a chemistry degree and has extensive experience with semiconductors from working for Advanced Micro Devices. So in other words, folks, these are subject matter experts. These aren't just a couple of guys with notebooks running around investigating this case. The report is an analysis of radar records from the FAA and the National Weather Service, obtained through several Freedom of Information requests, and comparing them to witness accounts. Schultz and Powell concluded that the radar data confirms the witness observations of an object, as well as the Air Force's statement that said 10 aircraft were operating in the area. They say that it is too difficult to say what the witnesses saw, but that there was something there. Twice, they say, radar picked up an object traveling at nearly 2,000 miles an hour, and at other times it showed a slow-moving object. Much media attention has been focused on the report's observation that radar records show one of the two objects moving directly towards the Prairie Chapel Ranch in Crawford. This is the home of the then U.S. President George W. Bush, which has been nicknamed the Western White House. They did not draw any conclusion as to why such movement was observed. What came as a fairly mild shock to Schultz upon reviewing the FOIA data was how primary and secondary radar systems at Fort Worth tracked an aerial intruder, without a transponder, mind you, for more than an hour as it made a steady southeasterly course from the Stephenville area towards the Bush Ranch. With F-16s thundering around in the general vicinity, the thing apparently slipped below the radar coverage from 7.03 p.m. to 7.10 p.m., accelerated minutes later to 532 miles an hour within a 30-second span, then skidded to 49 miles an hour 10 seconds later. The narrative comes to an abrupt and tantalizing halt at 8 p.m., the end of the 4 to 8 p.m. data windows requested by Schultz's FOIA. At that moment, the UFO was only 10 miles from Bush's home and 4 miles from the edge of the no-fly zone. The data shows there was definitely something there that was going on a fairly straight line, Schultz said. All the other planes in that air that night were turning and banking, but this was not. This was not on a chaotic path. It shows some intelligence for its ability to stay on a straight line course. The authors also concluded that military air activity was heavy at the time, but that the radar records show no overt action towards the unknown object. They expressed concern about the possibility that this could have been a terrorist aircraft with no transponder. Schultz and Powell stated that they felt that they had been stonewalled in some of their FOIA requests by some government agencies. They encouraged the government to more readily provide more information about the incident. Schultz wants to know why the flight logs of 10 military aircraft, separate and apart from the F-16s, were censored out in his FOIA. He wants to know why the F-16s encroached into civilian airspace, creating a potential safety hazard. And of course, he wants to know what the defense radar was tracking. The U.S. Air Force initially said witnesses must have seen reflections coming from commercial airliners. However, they later clarified that 10 F-16 Fighting Falcons had been on a nighttime training mission in the area on January 8th. In the interest of public awareness, Air Force Reserve Command Public Affairs realizes an error was made regarding the reported training activity of military aircraft, said the statement. According to Air Force spokesman Carl Lewis, the aircraft were from the 457th Fighter Squadron, and the error in the initial report was due to, quote, internal communications problems between offices at the base, unquote. Criticisms of the official explanation. While federal officials insist there's a logical explanation, locals swear that it was larger, quieter, faster, and lower to the ground than an airplane. They also said the object's lights changed configuration, unlike those of a plane. People in several towns who reported seeing it over several weeks have offered similar descriptions of the object. One account I found reads as follows. My grandfather has land about 60 miles away from Stephenville, closer to Brownwood, and would mostly hear, strain to see, F-16s having mock dogfights. Sometimes you'd get sonic booms. Occasionally an F-16 would crash in the countryside. You would never see F-16s flying over a populated area like Stephenville, performing some type of exercise, for obvious reasons. However, you do see private planes. The bottom line is, the explanations to the UFOs given by the Air Force do not match witness testimony in this case. It's well documented in UFO cases that fighter jets will scramble after a UFO. Witnesses reported F-16s, who wouldn't normally fly over the town, chasing a massive UFO. Now you're starting to see a sloppy job of a cover-up that is starting to arouse suspicions. Also, you're starting to see a pattern to these UFO reports in describing the craft. At least three pilots in Stephenville disagree with the military's press release as well. Stephen Allen, Don Doc Stewart, and Todd Downs all say if Stephenville and the Selden area are within the Brownwood military operating area, it's news to them. All three pilots say that space does not include all of Erith County. It only includes a small portion of Dublin and does not include Stephenville or the Selden area at all. Stephenville is 10 miles from the MOA, Stewart said. Downs, who is an employee at Clark Field in Stephenville, said there is a GPS fixed point located on the airport grounds that the military uses, and while it's not unusual for the jets to be in the area, he believes the press release leads people to believe that all of Erith County airspace is included in the MOA, and that's incorrect. He said jets fly through on the way to the MOA. Downs said he does not understand why the military would issue such a release 2 weeks after repeatedly denying the base had any planes in the area. I don't understand why they would do that at all, Downs said. It's not hard to know when they are there. It doesn't make any sense. I've seen them come by me before. They're real loud, and it's not hard to know that they are working in the area. Ken Cherry said that he thinks the military came clean for several reasons. Allen and friends reported early on that F-16s were chasing the mysterious lights when they saw them for the second time at Selden on the evening of January the 8th. We filed Freedom of Information Acts, and that may have prompted them to make the statement, Cherry said. This only proves our witnesses are more reliable than the Air Force. Ricky Sorrell stated soon after he went on the record that he believes military officials have been harassing him by flying military aircraft over his property at low altitudes at all hours of the day and night. Sorrells runs livestock on his place and said the cattle don't react well to the disturbances. It's also been hard to get any sleep. Not just once, but four times he claims to have seen the massive flying object he estimates to be the length of three or four football fields. He said he's not sure about the size because the first time he saw it was the best view. At that time, the craft hovered directly over him in the woods, about 300 feet above his head, and his view was blocked by tree branches. He's convinced that someone representing himself as a lieutenant colonel knows what it is, and Sorrells wants an explanation. He said the man contacted him by telephone on January the 15th, 2008, one day after his interview with the Associated Press. I didn't worry about writing his name down or taking notes, Sorrells said. I didn't know what was about to happen, but I think he said he was with the Air Force. Sorrells said the conversation started out nice enough. He was sort of nice to me right off, Sorrells said. He asked to come and talk to me. Sorrells said he told the man that he needed time to think about it, and then he, the man, became really arrogant. The caller told Sorrells that he wasn't taking no for an answer, and he would be out to talk to him. Sorrells again tried to politely tell the man he did not wish to have company. After that, Sorrells said the conversation became heated, and he told the man not to cross his cattle guard. Sorrells said the man responded with, "Son, we have the same caliber weapons as you do, but a lot more of them." Looking back, Sorrells said he believes the man was in his area, but not able to pinpoint exactly where he lived because he had recently built a new home. "I actually got up and looked out my window to see if I could see someone at the cattle guard. So I said if he was who he said he was, why didn't he stop flying over my airspace with all those damned helicopters? And he informed me that it was not my airspace, it was his. He told me if I'd quit talking about what I saw, he would stop the helicopters." Sorrells said since that conversation, the helicopters have quit flying over his property, but the F-16s haven't slowed down. Before the conversation took place with the suspected military officer, Sorrells related a late-night experience with a large transport helicopter and three smaller helicopters. "I get up at 2:30 a.m. to go to work, and these helicopters kept flying over, and I couldn't sleep," Sorrells said. "Because it was about time to get up and go to work, I just got up and went outside to see what I could." Sorrells said he has a spotlight on his pickup that he uses to look for coyotes. "I went to my truck and turned on the spotlight and shined it up at them," Sorrells said. "They were so close I could see the pilot's reaction. He threw up his arms to block the light. He was in one of the smaller helicopters. Then he turned towards me, and I still had the light on. I started to feel uncomfortable, so I turned off the light and waved and went back inside. I was thinking I'd really pushed the envelope." To top that off, Sorrells said that an acquaintance, who he would not name, and formerly a member of the military, told him, "You need to shut your mouth about what you saw." Sorrells said he tried to pull the man aside and ask him to explain his statement. "He just kept saying the same thing and he wouldn't explain," Sorrells said. "Now he won't speak to me at all." Sorrells said because the helicopters disappeared, he now feels the gentleman was actually a member of the military and was high enough in rank that he was able to stop that type of air traffic. "If it is a military craft, the American people need to know," Sorrells said. "A lot of people have seen things around here. I know what I saw, and so do they." Leroy Gayton said that what he saw that night could not have been jets. "There's no way F-16s can maneuver like that," Gayton said. "I really think it's some kind of military project or experiment. Too many people have seen things. I've spoken to at least one person, witness, the military has contacted," Gayton said. Another interesting twist is that local Stephenville newspaper reporter Angelina Joyner, who helped cover the sightings, was no longer working at the Stephenville Empire Tribune newspaper effective Thursday, February the 7th of 2008. Joyner had been covering the UFO story, which broke early in January and brought national and international news media representatives and researchers to Stephenville, other nearby towns in the surrounding region. She now travels the country as a UFO researcher. Joyner apparently felt that people in her community had a need to know about what was going on then. Respectable citizens came forward with their accounts and subsequent serious incidents reportedly involving the safety and threats to local family. What you read above is something out of communist China or Russia, but no, folks, that's the U.S. Now, most people think that that's where the story goes cold, right? January 2008, three nights of sightings, and that's all, correct? Well, even I was surprised to find out the following. Well, how about bookend sightings before and after? UFO researcher and author Lisa A. Scheel notes that a nearly identical sighting occurred 4 years earlier, only 65 miles northeast of Stephenville. Scheel knows because she witnessed the incident herself. As I've covered, in July of 2008, MUFON released its report about the Stephenville mass sighting with extensive corroborating radar data and an artist's rendering of eyewitness descriptions near the town of Selden. That sketch is nearly identical to what Scheel and her mother saw in January of 2004. The Selden witnesses described four lights arranged in two slightly offset, parallel rows of two lights each. The Scheels witnessed six lights in two slightly offset, parallel rows of three each. Just as reported by the Selden witness, the brightness of the lights Scheel saw made it difficult to tell whether the lights hung from a large object or were separate objects as they hovered about 100 feet off the ground at the crest of a hill. They were huge, Scheel says, and so bright you could see the glow from the other side of the next hill. During the sighting, Scheel also experienced missing time, a well-known phenomenon wherein a witness cannot account for a significant period of time during or immediately after a UFO sighting. As the Scheels sat in her car, watching the lights for what they both thought was only a few minutes, at least 25 minutes actually passed. The experience played a key role in spurring Lisa Scheel to start her own paranormal research group, Backyard Phenomena Investigations, or BPI. Scheel also discussed the sightings in her book, Backyard Bigfoot. As the former chief investigator for MUFON's Michigan chapter, Scheel knows that most of the sightings reported to such groups go uninvestigated. All volunteer organizations like MUFON are often spread too thin, Scheel says. People's work and family lives come before their UFO investigations. When mass sightings like the Stephenville case attract media attention, UFO researchers clamor to interview witnesses. Yet sightings like Scheel's and other witnesses openly listed in online databases like the one on MUFON's website demonstrate that similar objects have been spotted recently and repeatedly over many years in the same geographic area. In late October of 2008, it looks like whatever was visiting Stephenville was back. You could see the oval shape. Got my friend, and I said, dude, you got to come and look at this, said Andy Monreal. Monreal was hanging out with his Dublin high school friends when they all saw something they say looked like a UFO. You could see a shape. It was like a complete circle, said Monreal. He rolled off a half minute of video on his mom's digital camera. His dad saw it too. I never seen nothing like that in my life. Big lights and everything, his father said. So did mom. It was a round thing. You could see lights around it, flickering and changing. It was awesome. Just turning and flickering, she said. On the night of Monday, October 27, 2008, Michael Korn, 27, and a former member of the U.S. Army, who was living in Dublin, says he saw the following. I could see the bottom of the object from the illumination of those lights and the city lights, Korn said. The bottom of the craft looked smooth. It was brightly lit, and hovering lights pulsed in a right-to-left direction. The lights were an amber or orange color. He observed the object for about 15 seconds, and then suddenly it disappeared without making a sound. Korn's girlfriend, Ashley Couch, also observed the object. It reminded me of a carousel lying on its side, she said. Another witness, for the sake of anonymity, will be called Leslie. It was coming down at a slight angle, slowly. It had a bright big light, a steady light, and a blinking light, she said, for a total of three. One was red, and maybe that was the one that was blinking. I'm not sure, Leslie said. It looked almost like it was hovering. The lights were so bright, it was hard to see the shape, but the bottom looked a silver-gray color. Reporter Whitney Ashley said many people don't want to talk publicly, like several workers at the paper who also saw the lights. I've got at least 10 right now willing to go on record, Ashley said. The Sheriff's Department got lots of calls in the southern part of Erith County, down around Dublin, home of Dr. Pepper. The Joint Reserve Base in Fort Worth confirmed seven F-16s training in the area at the time. Several witnesses told us they saw fighters after they saw the mysterious lights. So what are we left with here, folks? Sunlight shining off of two commercial airliners? Never mind the fact the sightings occurred over 3 days and well after dark. Was it as the military claims? Just aircraft that conveniently forgot they were operating in the area until the case exploded in the media? Why were these aircraft coming so close to restricted airspace at the Bush Ranch then? How were these aircraft operating at such high and then low speeds as shown on the military's own radar? What shall we blame that on this time? Mechanical errors? Flocks of birds? The planet Venus? Considering the amount of times I've now heard world militaries, but especially the U.S. military, by the way, easily the most high-tech and well-funded armed forces in history, say, "Our radar malfunctioned. God help us all, should a child fly a kite near one, we may have the start of World War III. Is it a secret military project? Well, that is definitely plausible, but if that's the case, it's light years ahead of anything that we have been clued into by the government so far. Something approximately 1 mile long, half a mile wide, that according to radar can travel at least 2,000 miles an hour, as well as 50 miles an hour, without falling out of the sky, definitely isn't on display at your nearest air show. Is it something much more advanced from much further away? Well, anything's possible, and if we continue to have them revisiting the area, we may someday get an answer to our questions." As always, folks, I leave you with a quote from Art Bell. And that quote is, "A mind should not be so open that the brain falls out. However, it should not be so closed that whatever gray matter does reside within may not be reached."